This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, October 9th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Inevitably, when you get a shock of this nature, there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of human suffering because of it.
Back in April, John Cassidy talked with me about the impact of the COVID pandemic on the economy. At the time, the stock market was in free fall, unemployment was soaring, and Congress had recently passed a stimulus bill designed to stave off economic disaster. Or as John described it at the time, the initial phase of economic disaster.
What often happens in an economic catastrophe is you have a first round big economic shock, and that feeds through the system and everybody starts laying people off, etc. Then you have a second round, which a financial crisis develops because firms and people all start defaulting on their loans, and then you get a financial spiral down.
Over the past 6 months, the stock market has rebounded and unemployment has dropped, but millions are still out of work, and entire sectors of the economy, from restaurants to airlines, are on the brink of collapse. Many, including Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, now fear that without significant government intervention, the government could go into a spiral, the outcome of which could be unprecedented. John Cassidy joins me to discuss whether a second economic collapse is coming and how or if it can be avoided. John, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me back, Dorothy.
So let's start with a quick review of where we are. I think a lot of us are dizzied by all of this. When we talked in April, unemployment was way up and the stock market was way down. That made sense. People were in lockdown. They weren't spending money. Businesses were closing. Since then, unemployment has fallen a bit, but the stock market has completely rebounded and has actually been pretty stable in recent months. How is that possible?
Well, Dorothy, I think it is worth reviewing, as you say. When I spoke to you in April, we were really at the depths. What we had here, we had the initial huge shock, the COVID shutdowns, but we then had this astonishing policy response, which I think people don't realize quite the scale of. We basically had the biggest stimulus we've had since the Second World War, about between $2 and $3 trillion, between 10 and 15% of GDP. To put that into context, during the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the Obama stimulus was about 2 to 3% of GDP. So we're talking at least three times, maybe four or five times as big a policy response. We gave very generous unemployment benefits relative to history, an extra $600 per person. There were the PPP program, which basically gave money to firms to stop laying people off. And there were a whole series of Federal Reserve programs, lending money, propping up the financial markets. And then there were the cash payments to everybody in the country who earns less than $100,000 and kids. You put all that together, and what it managed to do was to stop the sort of catastrophic second round. And in parts of the economy actually rebounded quite rapidly. GDP looks like in the third quarter, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, it may have increased at about, again, 30%. Unemployment has basically reduced from 14.7% in April. It's currently at 7.9%. So we've had basically a halfway recovery in the labor market. And there's two ways to look at that. One of it is to say, well, that's better than most people expected, including myself. But on the other hand, things are nowhere near back to where they were before, and there's been a huge increase in inequality, and the costs of the recession have been focused on the people who can least afford to bear it, basically. If you look at the figures for employment, for example, if you think about it, it's pretty obvious the people who've been hardest hit are the people who work in industries which haven't come back, like hospitality, restaurants, leisure resorts, etc. People who work in those industries tend to be disproportionately low income, disproportionately minority. So if you look at some recent figures, the Wall Street Journal highlighted this week, you see that, for example, among African-American women, they're still 12% down in terms of jobs. Hispanic women, 13% down in terms of jobs. There's an enormous section of the population who've been hit very hard. And going forward, they could well get even hit even harder because the huge stimulus, which I spoke about, is now basically run out. And the whole debate on Capitol Hill is, of course, whether to renew it. And it looks like that there's not going to be any renewal before the election.
Economists, you included, have pointed out that the pace of the recovery depends on how quickly we can get the pandemic under control. And, you know, this morning I just looked at the numbers, and they just aren't good.
Yeah, I mean, I think I pointed out then, and it's been clear all along, that if you want a full economic recovery, the first thing you have to do is bring the virus under control, and not just sort of roughly under control, but really bring it down substantially so that people can go back to work. I mean, the great example of that is China, where basically their economy seems to be back almost to normal now. Europe is somewhere in the middle. Some of the countries have come back very strongly, like Germany, which also did a very good job of tackling the virus. And then the countries which did a horrible job of tackling the virus, like the UK and the USA and Brazil, their economies are doing the worst, relatively speaking.
Trump, unsurprisingly, takes all the credit for what he continues to say is, you know, the best economy ever. The media comes back and points out that the president actually doesn't make some of the most important decisions here. Just this week, Axios published a piece arguing that the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, not Trump, deserves credit for the stock market's highs and for voters' continuing confidence in the administration's economic policies, even while their assessment of his handling of other issues, including the pandemic, is not good at all. Do you agree with that argument?
Yes. Well, I think the Federal Reserve definitely deserves a lot of credit, because going back to the basic story I laid out, in which you get an initial shock and then it feeds through the financial system and you get a financial crisis, and that's what leads to a downward spiral into a Great Depression. The Federal Reserve basically stepped in and stopped that second stage by acting as a lender of last resort to the entire economy, really. They basically said more or less explicitly that they were going to do whatever was necessary to prevent that downward spiral and collapse. And that worked. It restored confidence in the financial markets. It enabled big corporations to start raising money again. And it stopped. It headed off the second big collapse. But also, I do think Congress deserves a lot of credit as well, because they did come together in March and passed the $2.2 trillion CARES Act, but there were also two or three other bills. And if you added it all together, that was $3 trillion. Now, as that policy response has worn out, you're seeing the immediate response in the airlines starting to lay off thousands of people. Disney the other day announced tens of thousands of redundancies. And that's going to spread out throughout the economy in the coming months if there isn't another rescue package.
And of course, the Fed is closely involved with political decisions, even if the Fed chair doesn't usually like to get involved in the back and forth. So it was interesting to hear Powell give a pretty emphatic speech last week to the National Association for Business Economics, arguing for another government stimulus.
Too little support would lead to a weak recovery, creating unnecessary hardship for households and businesses. Over time, household insolvencies and business bankruptcies would rise, harming the productive capacity of the economy and holding back wage growth. By contrast, the risks of overdoing it seem, for now, to be smaller. Even if policy actions ultimately prove to be greater than needed, they will not go to waste. The recovery will be stronger and move faster if monetary policy and fiscal policy continue to work side by side to provide support to the economy until it is clearly out of the woods.
So, John, I'm guessing you agree that it's better to err on the side of doing too much than doing too little and then worrying later about the deficit.
Yes. I mean, if you just think about it in terms of basic economics, the government finances the money it would spend for a stimulus by issuing bonds. Some people, modern monetary theorists, say it should just print the money, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. They issue bonds and add to the national debt. Now, the danger is that if you do too much of that, investors will balk and won't buy the bonds, so their prices will collapse and you get a big increase in interest rates, which could choke off the rest of the economy. That's called crowding out in economic jargon. There's absolutely no sign of that happening at the moment. Interest rates for the last few years have been at record lows. Short-term interest rates are basically zero now. In some countries, they're actually negative. But even long-term interest rates, the interest you get on buying a 30-year government bond, are really very low. In fact, they've never been so low in recent history. What that indicates is that the markets are not worried about the US government going bankrupt anytime in the near future, and they're willing to buy more bonds. The government can basically, at this stage, federal government can lend at virtually zero cost in terms of once you include inflation.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
And now to the presidency. Trump's pronouncements, just in pure political terms, seem utterly mystifying to me. So a week ago, he supported Congress's efforts to pass another relief bill. This Tuesday, he called off stimulus negotiations until after the election. On Wednesday, he announced that negotiations were back on. So what is this all about?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's impossible to read Trump's mind. I mean, my reading of the situation is that Trump would like a bill. I mean, it was obviously, as you say, it's in his political interest to announce a big rescue package before the election. It would probably give another boost to the stock market. It would be positive news. There's going to be more positive news with the GDP for the third quarter figure, which is going to be announced on October 29th. So if you had a big stimulus package plus the GDP figure, it would give Trump a bit of good news going the last couple of weeks as he desperately needs it. My reading of the situation is that it's the big blockage is in the Republican Party on Capitol Hill. The Senate Republican caucus just doesn't seem to be able to agree on a package because, mainly for ideological reasons, they think, you know, the government's getting too big, the national debt's getting too large. Even back as far as July and August, people like Ted Cruz were saying we can't have another big stimulus package, it's socialism in action, etc. And so Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been in the background. But I think it was him who stepped in this week and basically told the White House, this is a non-starter. And actually on Friday morning, McConnell said pretty much the same thing again. He said, I don't think there's going to be a deal before the election. And I think Trump's frustrated about that. So he's trying to put the blame on the Democrats, but he's also lashing out internally as well. McConnell could probably sell to his caucus a narrow or a skinny stimulus, which would include cash payments to everybody of another $1,000 for everybody who earns $100,000 or less, and some boost to unemployment benefits, but not as big as the Democrats want, and a bailout for the airlines. So those three elements could conceivably be included in a skinny package before the election, but the Democrats are saying that they won't agree on that. I think they probably will agree on a bailout for the airlines before the election, just because the airlines are saying we're about to lay off tens and tens of thousands of people. So it's still conceivable there'll be a deal on that. But the prospects of a broad, big stimulus package look to be pretty minimal at the moment. I mean, there's a bit of a suspicion on Wall Street that Mnuchin is keeping these talks going basically to try and keep the market going. They're terrified of a stock market, if not a crash, a big sell-off before the election, because
that's interesting. There's
not going to be another stimulus.
Biden is well ahead of Trump in the polls, and I say that with some skepticism, given what happened in 2016. But let's just say Biden is elected. He would almost certainly push through a stimulus package along the lines of what the congressional Democrats are doing, say, on the order of $2.2 billion. Could you talk a little bit about what Biden's broader economic plan would look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things here, Dorothy. Number one is there'd be an immediate stimulus, as you say. If he got a sweep, they'd obviously definitely push it through. But even if the Republican majority was reduced to one or two in the Senate, it's quite probable that they'd get enough Republican support. Maybe Romney, maybe Murkowski, maybe one or two other Republicans. to get a substantial package put through in January or February. I think that's one of the reasons why, as I say, why the stock market hasn't collapsed in the last couple of weeks as the stimulus talks have broken down on Capitol Hill. Investors are starting to look ahead to January and February rather than focusing on what's happening now. The complicating factor is that Biden also has his Build Back Better plan, which is a program of long-term investments in things like infrastructure, green energy, education, etc. How much of that does he try to rush through in January or February? Does he do one enormous spending bill, which would include the stimulus package plus the major elements of his Build Back Better plan? Or does he push through a big what would be a big stimulus package, as you said, and then try and come back a few months later and do the long-term bill in a separate legislative initiative? I've been speaking to some people around that who you know, involved in the Biden campaign or advise the Biden campaign. It's hard to tell. A lot depends on how the Senate races go. If the Democrats end up with a majority in the Senate, a workable majority, they can afford to take their time a bit more. But at the moment, I think people are looking towards one big combined bill, the sort of Biden stimulus stroke Build Back Better plan, all in one enormous package that they'd put through in reconciliation.
On the subject of Biden, I want to go back to what seems like a lifetime ago, way back early in the primary season, when Democrats were excited about Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, and some of the other candidates. You were telling our colleagues not to underestimate Joe Biden, and we all kind of dismissed you. Why did you believe that then? And what do you think about how he's handling himself as the nominee?
Yeah, I mean, I was just driven by the polling data, really. I mean, if you looked at the polling data all along, it looked like Biden was had a sort of broadest support in the general election electorate. And when you're in a primary, it's a completely different electorate. So Biden wasn't very attractive to large parts of the Democratic electorate, the progressive, highly educated base of the party, which dominates primaries. But consistently in the head-to-head polls against Trump, he came out ahead. And why is that? Because he does have a sort of broad range of people who think they may not be usually enthusiastic for him, but they certainly prefer him over Trump. He's got a lot of support among ordinary Black Americans. Surprisingly, for a Democrat in the modern era, he's also got quite a lot of support among white working class Americans. And you're seeing that in the Midwest now. You see it in the polling in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If he does well among the minorities, plus does reasonably among the white working classes, then the Democratic base is going to vote for anybody over Trump. So it always just seemed to me that Biden's, you know, he had a three-legged stool as opposed to most of the other candidates only having a two-legged stool. And that does seem to be how the election has played out. The question was always, is he a sort of, you know, a good enough candidate to last through the campaign? I think what we saw in the debate was that, I would be the last person to say he gave a great performance, but he was good enough. He didn't break down. Trump was attacking him. It looked like a very cynical attempt to get him to stutter to me.
Yes.
And it didn't work. Biden kept his cool. He talked to some of his answers were too long, as they always are, but he had things to say. And immediately after, ever since that debate, the polls have shown him, you know, 10, 12 points clear. But at the moment, it looks a bit like the debate was similar to the 1980 debate with Reagan and Carter, when the country was basically was sick of Jimmy Carter, whether that's justified or not. Yeah, polls were actually pretty close going into the debate. Reagan did well enough in the debate. And then the polls immediately after that debate widened, and Reagan ended up winning by 9 points and carrying 44 states. I'm not saying Biden's going to do anything like that. The country's far too polarized and divided, I think, to get that size of a victory. But the election does seem to have followed that dynamic so far. And, you know, with only 3 weeks left, it's going to be very difficult for Trump to change around that dynamic.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
John Caste is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes a column about politics and economics for NewYorker.com and is the author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.